Dr. Hogan is an independent advisor and consultant with Hogan Health Solutions. He serves on the Executive Committee of the National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention, a public and private partnership advancing the national strategy for suicide prevention. Dr. Hogan's presentation will address dealing with behavioral health issues in your facility. Dr. Hogan.
Well, there's some good news and bad news. All we have to do is figure out the mental health system between now and lunch. And we have not that much time to do it. So this should be quite entertaining. I should say at the outset that I'm neither an attorney nor a physician nor a risk manager. So what are my qualifications for doing this? Well, you've already heard I've been around a long time. Can't keep a job, been in multiple places. I think probably my one distinguishing qualification is that I'm relatively certain that I've been sued more frequently than anybody else in the room. Now, half of those lawsuits are brought by, while I was in New York, they're, what do you call it, per se? Is that when the guy defends himself, or he's his own? Pro se. These are brought by inmates in the state correctional system who have mental health issues. They're very entertaining, never mind. okay, I also should say at the outset, I wanna try to catch up a little bit in terms of time, so go quickly through some stuff that is probably not that consequential. Either you already know it or you don't want to know it, related to the significance and complexity of mental health issues. And I think that I was thinking we're hearing the last presentation that, and I said to Dr. Marin that I wish he could come up and do the psychiatric one. He demurred in that regard. But I think we're moving in some ways from the sublime to the ridiculous here, because the core issue in mental health, I could go back and quote a line from our interim report to President Bush: the mental health system is a shambles. That's the core issue and the core problem. And so the issue of how good practice takes place in a system that is so screwy and screwed up is really a challenge. And so if I have any advice here at all, it's going to be just sort of, I guess it sort of comes down to, if you're operating in healthcare, you've got this hot potato. And to mix metaphors, the cavalry is not coming. The hope of getting fixes or solutions from what used to be the mental health system is kind of sort of slim to none. And my advice to you would be figure out what you can do on your own in your own program. So having said that, I want to sort of lead up to that and describe it a little bit more. So this is the part where you already know this or you don't care. This mental health stuff is a pretty good deal. This is data from the WHO on the proportion of a burden, if you will. In this case, it's a measure of disability attributable to mental health problems, like it's significant in getting worse. One of the other challenges, and this is going to be a theme throughout what I say, is that these are not standalone conditions. There are more patients with mental health problems seen in the general medical context than by all mental health specialists put together. So these patients are in your program, even if you're not a psychiatrist. But they're disproportionately concentrated in patients that have got other medical illnesses. So for patients that have got another chronic medical illness, the rate of a co-occurring mental health problem is about 35%. Or patients that have acute medical illness. So about 35% of the patients in your hospital beds with an acute mental illness have got some mental health problem that's probably going to complicate their management of their condition when they get out. That's one of the sort of, that's going to be one of the recurring themes here. And the fact that these patients tend to have comorbid conditions greatly complicates their adherence to your treatment recommendations and means that their health problems are likely to recur. Like, you know, my mother who had diabetes and depression, as long as she was treating her depression, she was managing her diabetes. If she stopped treating her depression, blood sugar, you know, all over the place with sometimes significant kinds of issues and problems. Here is the thing that makes this, complicated or hopeful or screwed up. You can pick that, and that is, we used to have a mental health system. You know, it was sort of state hospitals. It was entirely separate from the health system per se. Well, that system has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, deinstitutionalization. As that took place, there were inadequate provisions made for that kind of care. We never built a community mental health system, really, that was adequate. And now here's the kicker. Responsibility has now moved into the mainstream. So you've got the patients. The regs may not have caught up with that. The payment almost certainly hasn't caught up with it, but you've got the patients. Just as another marker of this, you see how the bottom of this slide, outpatient care paid out of pocket or delivered in state-financed mental health centers. American Psychiatric Association, through polling their members, has found that less than half of practicing psychiatrists take insurance. So half of the supply of the leading profession doesn't take insurance. They're only doing out of pocket kind of work, which means that they're probably really not accessible to other health providers on a referral basis. And just to make this point about how care is now ending up in your lap, if you're in a hospital, if you're in a clinic, these forces are pretty powerful. The first of those is that care is now paid for as a part of a benefit, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, or commercial, rather than paid through a separate line item through the state mental health department. So it's in the plan. And this has been accelerated and reinforced by this MAHEPA legislation. That's the so-called mental health parity, Domenici Wellstone, which sort of says you can't really treat, if you're an insurance plan, you can't really treat brain conditions different from other health conditions. You have to use the same logic for all that. The ACA builds that standard into essentially everything. So you've got this situation now where the benefit is really in the plan, even though practice and payment hasn't caught up with it quite yet. So and just as an illustration of how it hasn't caught up yet, you have the Attorney General of New York over the course of the last year announcing findings or settlements or fines with six or seven different health plans for their failure to equitably treat or reimburse for care for mental health problems. So increasingly, the benefit is in the plans. Some of the treatments are now within scope of practice for medical practitioners in general. And the best answer for that, or the best example of that, probably is the SSRIs, Prozac, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those new antidepressants aren't really more better. They aren't really more efficacious than the old antidepressants, but they're easier to dose, they're safer to monitor, and that most of the prescriptions for them are written by, not by psychiatrists, but by general practitioners and other medical specialists. So care, to some extent, has moved into the mainstream. This one is a big kicker, and that is that patients don't want to go see a shrink, on average. They would rather go to their doctor, their physician, or they'd rather go to their clinic and not have to walk in through a separate door when they get there. So we have an alignment of, to some extent, of treatments, an alignment of patient preferences, an alignment of health insurance. And so what's the bottom line that's starting to emerge is this recognition that the comorbid mental health problems are common and costly. So in a sense, the big problem in mental health these days is not in mental health. The mental health system still is what it is. It's like end-stage renal disease. It's over here. It's separate payment. It's stigmatized. It's staying the way it is. But mental health care is becoming more like heart disease care. It's becoming more like cardiology. So the patients are in clinics. They're in general medical settings. There still is a need for the high-end interventional stuff where you better get a specialist. But increasingly, the care is in the mainstream. And we're not so good at that, and it costs a lot of money. So here's an illustration of this. The guy's out on the ledge, and the cop is saying, "We couldn't get a psychiatrist, but maybe you'd like to talk about your skin. I was able to find a dermatologist," which is sort of, you know, sums up the way it works or it doesn't work. So, and one of the kickers is that, this goes to my line about the cavalry is not coming, referral to that specialty system doesn't work so very well. So just sort of thinking about what's the obligation of a treating and referring physician, I'll just give a couple of examples of that. You know, this survey after survey, general practitioners report more dissatisfaction with referrals to psychiatry than any other specialty. It's last every time the survey is done, and it's last by a considerable amount. So you can't get in. The supply isn't there. They're not taking patients with insurance that are there, and there's a line stretching out the door at the Community Mental Health Center. So there's that. Here's another measure of coordination approaches. You know, sort of if we look at what's the national standard for follow-up care for patients with psychiatric illnesses discharged from an inpatient unit, it would be the HEDIS standard of one visit within 7 days. Now, first of all, that's an inadequate standard for some patients. Patients that are suicidal and are getting out of an inpatient unit, 7 days is too long to wait, number one. Number two, performance on that, I think, is worst of any HEDIS measure that exists. So across all health plans in the United States, performance is about 47%. So the cavalry is not coming, and referrals to them are unlikely to work well. And as a therapist friend of mine used to say, it's okay to want that. So you can sort of hope that that would work, but it wouldn't exactly be rational. This is just a diagram of in the blue circle, patients with mental disorders. What proportion of them have a co-occurring medical problem, a majority of them, and patients with medical problems, the big circle, what proportion of them have a co-occurring mental disorder, a pretty significant number. And it's much more concentrated, as I said, for people that have got more serious medical illnesses. So comorbidity is actually typical, not any other way around. And this is just an illustration on how what I would call disintegration is costly. So for this is data from a colleague of mine, Roger Cathal, who says that the average 200-bed community hospital is spending about $1.5 million annually on sitters for patients with behavioral issues on a medical floor. So it's expensive and it's not helping the patient. And so the question of what else you do is complicated. The bottom line of that for me and all the stuff is it'd be better to think about ways to begin treating that proactively, even though it's hard to do and the regs and the money might not follow. So 35% of patients on med-surg floors have a co-occurring mental health problem. That's going to increase their time in the hospital by about a day and a half, which is starting to become expensive for the hospital. It's costing money as opposed to making money as we move toward alternative payment arrangements. And also, when the patients get out, the readmission rates are higher because the patients aren't self-managing very well. We did this is like dated, but 2007, we did an analysis here in New York and looked at all readmissions of patients within 30 days. Now, we didn't know whether the readmissions were, they might have been medically appropriate readmissions, so we don't know if they're appropriate or inappropriate, but let's like assume that a readmission is a problem. So, and divided the readmissions into three buckets. The first bucket was a pure behavioral readmission. That was about 35% of all Medicaid readmissions. The second bucket was a pure medical readmission. That was about 15%. In other words, 50% of all Medicaid hospital readmissions in New York was a readmission for medical reasons of a patient with a behavioral problem, which wasn't really treated. So the problems are significant, and I'm not going to dwell on these because you either, like as I said, you either already know it or it's not that not that interesting. This is just a summary of that data. This is that same guy, Roger Cathal, who, if you're in a hospital that's interested in doing something about this and want a resource, Roger said I could use his slide if I pushed his company. So his company is Cartesian Solutions, and they work in this this kind of space. This is data from multiple medical plans of total cost of care of all patients. And the big thing here is to look at and see that the cost of care for all patients is about $3,000 per year. They're not using much. In particular, they're not using much inpatient care. And then down the left-hand column, you see the average cost of care of patients with various medical conditions, chronic medical illness, arthritis, cancer, COPD, et cetera, et cetera. And then you see the percentage of these patients in the overall case mix, and then the percentage of them that have comorbid medical illness. So this is where you see the rates of 30 to 40% and higher. So what you see is the dramatic increase in cost that is attributable to the co-occurring mental health problem. So you see it tends on average for patients with chronic illness to double the cost of care. And the number here is that 10% of these patients are getting evidence-based mental health care. So it's a lack of treatment and a lack of good treatment that is the cost driver here. Now I want to turn to a little bit about, like, you know, what's effective, what does work. And there's not a long list here because this issue is so new. The problem has been there's been a separate mental health system, and we could sustain the illusion that they would take care of these problems, and that illusion is crumbling under the realities of clinical needs and changes in the law and so on. So here are a list of good ideas, or supposedly good ideas, that actually are ineffective. And these are things that people periodically talk about. Well, that's the solution to that problem. Now, these slides are borrowed from Jürgen Unitzer, who's the chairman of psychiatry at University of Washington and one of the main proponents of integrating psychiatric care with primary care. So the first of those is screening for something without doing enough to address it once you screen for it. So why bother? Jürgen is Swiss. So, of course, his statement here is you can't fatten a cow by weighing it, very Swiss kind of thing. A second thing is we'll train people about this. Well, training is not going to be adequate. And a newer trend in that regard, you know, particularly through health plans and so on, is, you know, telephonic disease management. It might work for some patients, but it's not going to work for these. It's like kind of sort of a waste of time. So these are things that you might think would work, but they're not going to be robust enough. That leads to the question of what do we know about what is effective in treating these conditions. There's even less evidence here about what to do in the hospital, although I'm going to offer a few ideas. The best evidence is what to do in medical clinic or primary care settings. And it basically is, to quote Frank DeGry, who's a colleague in family practice, I asked Frank, you know, can you give me a good quote on why primary care should be doing a better job with bringing in mental health care? And he said, well, how's about this? If 40% of the patients coming in have got some kind of a mental health issue or challenge, which he says that's about what we think the number is in family practice. And if every patient who has a chronic medical illness is going to require behavior change to manage their medical illness, then shouldn't we get good at this? So that in a sense is the case for this. the best approach to this, and there are a bunch of inadequate ways to do that, as it also turns out, but the best approach is this thing called collaborative care, now 80-plus randomized control trials, and the key elements of it, you have to have some kind of behavioral health professional who's on the floor, on this floor, on the same floor as the medical people. Across town won't work. You know, upstairs might not work. They've got to be on the floor, and they've got to be available. So when, on a screening instrument done in the waiting room, you know, the treating physician notices a mental health challenge, they can say, can we have Mrs. Smith come down and meet you right now? And we'll work together on this concern of yours. I can do some things, she can do some things, and you're a critical part of this. So having the embedded behavioral health professional, measurement-based care, which is becoming standard for other chronic illnesses, works here as well. So the idea is the most common condition is going to be depression. Start them on something. Measure how it's going. If they're doing well or getting better, it's working. If they're not doing well and not getting better, try something else. Pretty simple approach. And then the availability of a psychiatrist for physician-to-physician consult with the internist or the family practice doc, which is, you know, that has just, Medicare has basically just said they'd pay for this. They wouldn't pay for it up until now, but they've just said they would pay for this, I think, as a part of the latest doc fix bill. So with these approaches, basically the results of outcomes in primary care approaches that use this are essentially as good as people seeing competent psychiatrists. So worked quite well. This is outcomes for depression treatment in usual care versus a collaborative care model. So the outcomes are better. I made this point about Medicaid. And then it turns out that the global medical costs are reduced by this kind of approach. This was a study in 8 different health plans where patients were randomized to either usual care or to a collaborative care approach with the, you know, the psych nurse, the treatment protocol, and the consulting psychiatrist. And so you see that this is the costs spread across all patients with depression were a little higher because of the cost of this program. But the overall costs were significantly reduced, and the biggest reduction was in inpatient medical costs, interestingly. Not for big, you know, so patients were getting better care, were getting better self-management for their other chronic medical problems, and they're having less medical readmissions. And sort of counterintuitively in some way, but consistent with most of the rest of what I'm saying, that was the big benefit. And then reduced pharmacy costs, also sort of interesting. So this sort of works better. Just a graph about, this is you know, a display which you can't see, but you know, that with routine use of a PHQ-9 and other kind of things like that in the waiting room, and that's how we're measuring whether the patient is getting better or not, as well as the conversation. But it's treatment that is being measured. So at this point, it gets more complex because the question is, well, what, you know, what works in other contexts than outpatient clinic care? I should also say parenthetically, the New York State has made a belated, you know, too late from my way of thinking about it, a belated commitment to saying that in the future in New York, well-functioning psychiatric care or mental health care is going to have to be a core element of patient-centered medical homes. And so they're gearing up for that, which is a good thing for the long term, but the changing the regs and changing the financing to catch up is always delayed. So if you're a hospital, what do you do? Or if you're in other kind of contexts, what do you do? Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of great answers. I mean, I keep coming back to this again. Waiting for the cavalry to come would not be rational. So trying to figure out what to do in your own setting, I think for me starts with trying to figure out what kind of approach to embedding behavioral health is feasible. And here are just a couple of examples of that. A consultation liaison psychiatrist who sees a patient's at the request of the treating physician, or to take it up a notch, in the case of situations where you can be pretty sure that there's a good risk of depression, following cardiac surgery, for example, post-stroke. These are situations where we almost should expect some depression, especially with men, to be able to see those patients and have ongoing management of the psychiatric condition as a part of the package. My note here is that it requires care management for this to work, because as we've already said, the follow-up care is going to be particularly important. The cardiac patient is not going to get probably a referral for separate psychiatric care if they've got this depression. Maybe if it's an extraordinary circumstance, they might. But figuring out how to stay on top of this after the patient leaves the hospital is really critical. So that you see the theme that's throughout this is figure out a way to embed behavioral health professionals across all these services. That really is the common element of how to do this. Now, Linda, sort of said when the committee that was looking at my stuff looked at this, there are a couple other questions that were popped up, and I'll just sort of mention a couple of these. So one of them was, what do you do about the, quote unquote, the problem patient, the patient with a comorbid medical condition who you know has got some kind of a mental health problem and isn't well engaged in care, isn't self-managing, and keeps coming back to the emergency room keeps coming back to inpatient? Well, this is going to be not very satisfactory, but don't expect the cavalry to come. I remember an experience, actually the first time that I was involved in a lawsuit. I inherited a state hospital in my first assignment in the field that was under a federal court agreement, and so I actually wasn't originally a defendant, but I inherited the case. And the mandate was to get, long-stay patients who were able to out of the state hospital. And we had one patient, been in there for years and years and years, had a very problematic history, lots of trauma and lots of issues, but she was doing very poorly in the hospital. So a really high priority to get her out, and we sort of put together this customized approach just for her. And the treatment team offered it to her, and she was like, no, which... sort of emboldened me. So the next meeting with the plaintiff's lawyer, I sort of went up one side of him and down the other. You're a patient, and we did this, and we put together. It's a Cadillac deal, and she wouldn't take it. So what are you going to do? And he said to me, do you feel better now that you've yelled at me? And I said, well, I feel a little bit better. And he said, okay, well, take a deep breath. I took a deep breath. And he said, you got to make her a better offer. But the thing was, he was essentially right. And the offer that ended up being, we didn't have to do a better offer. We had to work with that patient. And if we thought about it, her history of trauma meant that she really had, trust issues, was very afraid by this. And so we had to build up to a much more gradual transition plan and trial visits and all that stuff. And it ended up that the placement worked. So try another way or work to make a better offer is, I think, really a key part of this. One of the things that's emergent, some of you probably emergent in a good sense in the field, that some of you probably know about, is that one of the most helpful approaches to working with, quote-unquote, chronically mentally ill individuals, we don't like that label anymore, but people with very long-standing problems, is to employ people in recovery themselves, so-called peer specialists, as an ancillary part of the workforce. They can afford to spend more time, and because of their circumstances, a lot of time are pretty good at developing a trust relationship. And so we've seen that as a very useful approach in emergency departments and other kinds of settings. You know, the other thing that Linda asked about that I have no clue about, but I'll say a few things, is sort of what, so somebody had raised the question of what should we do about active shooters in the facility? Well, my first response was to say, well, that's actually a security problem. It's not a mental health problem. And I think that's true, but I went to the Joint Commission website to look at their very good guidance about how to prepare for this, and being kind of data-based, they had a record of all the active shooter situations in healthcare facilities between about 2010-2014, and it was 17 cases with 26 deaths. And here was the kicker. 9 of those were murder-suicides. So I'm going to slightly revise what I said before, and that's to say it primarily is has to be part of an emergency management plan. The Joint Commission standards for it are very good. God bless you if it happens to come up. But as like every other part of emergency management, having a contingency plan is better than not having none. And I'll get back to the suicide thing just in a minute before I close. I'm going to jump over this. Integrated care works better, saves money. You have that in front of you. And to just close, I'm going to offer a couple of resources at the end, but I'm going to close with a little conversation about something that in my introduction you would have heard that I'm engaged in, and that's suicide prevention. This is not suicide prevention in the old sense, which is it's a responsibility of somebody in public health, which is to say not much happens, because just like over there and it's over there and out of sight, out of mind. The part that I'm focused on is what could we be doing better in clinical settings, mental health programs, healthcare programs around suicide prevention. And so I'm going to predict that this is an area that's going to emerge very significantly. I think but this is all speculative on my part. I think that the standards of care are going to evolve rapidly. I think that litigation, which probably, you know, already occurs, you know, largely probably a problematic, quote unquote, problematic discharge or a failure to admit a patient to inpatient care, I think that's going to escalate and get more problematic. Just a little bit about what I think we're learning about this. One is that the medical neighborhood is not safe when it comes to suicide. Here are just some statistics about, you know, half the people dying by suicide saw a GP in the previous month. 70% of older men who die by suicide saw a GP in the month before they died. So this cannot be explained by chance. And I think I know what happened. You know, us older guys are not really that good at self-managing this emotional stuff. And even if we can know something's wrong, we're not going to go see a shrink. So we'll go to the physician we trust, but we don't have the language to explain what our problem is. There's some kind of pain, whether it's psychic or physical, and we're looking for help. That's why we're there. We're looking for help. And we don't get asked. And we don't have the tools, the patient doesn't have the tools to be able to ask ourselves. So this, to me, is very much aligned with the notion of the complete physical. But the complete physical in this context is being expanded a little bit to physical, plus a little bit beyond physical. This is data on suicide rates among patients in care. This is pretty bad data. You know, in Ohio, for example, 20% of all the suicides in the state are among people being cared for in the public mental health system. What percentage of people in Ohio get care in the public mental health system? 2%. In other words, there's a tenfold increase in suicide rate among people engaged in care. So it turns out that the place where people get sent if they're suicidal isn't really competent to deal with them. Most mental health professionals have no training, don't know how to do this, and there's a bunch of new tools that are actually pretty effective. So this is my sort of metaphor for it. It uses it's not the falling through the cracks, it's the falling through the holes in the Swiss cheese, which is Edward Reason's safety framework. So these are the things that we tend to not do. This didn't come through very well when it got transposed to you, but we tend to not ask. If we find a problem, we tend to not do something concrete while the patient is still in the office. So an example of a best practice workflow that's emerging is, first of all, you have to ask a patient who might have risk. So the people that are doing best practices are asking every patient under psychiatric care at every visit a suicide question. Every patient under mental health care at every visit. And then if we find something, the workflow is set up so that we talk a little bit more about why they're feeling that way, how they're feeling, have they made a plan? You have a gun, you're gonna use that. Can we call home now and have that gun be put in a safe place until you feel better? Would that be all right? And the workflow sets up this safety plan, and you don't go on with the session. You can't do anything else with the EMR until you take that kind of action. This one down here is really challenging. It's sort of turning out that, like right today, I would say that probably the implicit standard of care for the suicidal patient is put them in inpatient. Turns out the evidence is it doesn't work. It keeps them safe for the 5 days when they're in, because we've gotten pretty good on inpatient at monitoring them, but the patient is at greater risk the day they leave, probably, than they were when they were admitted. And they have high risk the next day and the day after and the day after, and you know the standard of care is see them once within 7 days. So as a matter of fact, the National Institute of Mental Health has got a request out now where they're asking people to provide information and suggest a research agenda for looking at the effectiveness of inpatient care for patients that are suicidal. And so that this is becoming challenging. The standard of care in the future is going to be we directly treat their suicidality in the hospital if we have to put them in, because if a patient is psychotic and suicidal, I wouldn't want them anyplace else. But we work with them on their suicidality when they're in the hospital. And finally, this is also, I think, going to become a standard of care. It turns out that the evidence is very strong that a small amount of follow-up contact to suicidal patients is life-saving. A good example of research on this is a randomized study that they did in Australia, psych hospital discharging patients to the outback. You know, not a lot of therapists out there. So the research study was simply a follow-up letter. Half the patients got a follow-up letter, half the patients didn't get a letter. You know, we were glad to have you with us. We know it was a hard time. You seem better when you left, but you have to take care of yourself. Any concerns, pick up the phone and give us a call. Save lives. Just the letter. So I believe that the standard of care for suicidal patients is going to evolve to, you have to ask about it. You have to develop a safety plan with them. You should give them psychotherapy that's relevant to suicide. And you have to follow up with them after you've seen them. The Joint Commission is working on a sentinel event alert to follow up on the one they did, I think, in 1998 on suicide. That focused just on inpatient. I expect the focus of that to be a little broader. So I'm not going to dwell on this. Henry Ford took this on systematically. This is their results. And I'm going to just end with some thoughts about some resources that are available. And so here's one. If you're in primary care, a website at ARC that focuses on resources related to integrating behavioral health into primary care. What are the standards? What are the tools? What are the screeners that work? What are the staffing arrangements? How to set that up. So that's one. Another one is at the University of Washington, where integrated primary care is sort of becoming like usual and customary, not the kind of every once in a while thing that it is here. This is the guy that I mentioned, Roger Kathol, who does consulting primarily with hospitals and integrated delivery systems on how to think through behavioral health issues. That's how to reach Roger. And then finally, this is a website. If you have an interest in what I would describe as suicide care, that we've put together, that is focused on how to lift the burden of care in or the standard of care in this regard as well. So, as I said at the outset, that this was going to be a little bit of the ridiculous coming from the sublime, but these issues are faced by everybody in the healthcare system out there. I don't want to offer any false hopes, but particularly for solutions, magic solutions coming from somewhere. But increasingly, hospitals and health systems are diving into this themselves and taking small practical steps to resolve the problem. And that's really what I would advise, small practical steps. And so with that, it's time for lunch. And but let me ask first if there are any questions. You're standing between us and lunch, but.
No.
Or or grab me if you want over lunch. We have one question. Yeah.
I'll keep this quick given the lunch. My name is Jim Kennedy, and I'm with the Federally Qualified Health Center in the Finger Lakes region. We're in a rural area. Dr. Hogan, what are your concerns in the DSRIP era, a delivery system reform incentive program era, which sounds a lot like disrupt, in terms of what now should be happening in the emergency room with referrals of patients on Medicaid to get the kind of care that you're describing? And then I have a workforce question around the use of psychiatric nurse practitioners and what kind of expectations we can have, again, especially in the rural areas. Thank you.
Well, the answer to the second question is, like, I'd be in favor of that. You know, so you're not going to be able probably to find psychiatrists. And so particularly nurse practitioners with psychiatric qualifications, I think worth their weight in gold. So I'd grab them. And there are scope of practice issues and there are supervision issues and there are all those other kind of things. But as a practical matter, I'd grab them. If I couldn't find them, I'd hire, you know, master's clinical nurse specialists with psychiatric experience as well and try to figure out, because they're also a tremendous resource. You know, I escaped just before DSRIP was happening, so I think I have some deniability, sort of on that. Is DSRIP a reform to increase integration and the appropriate participation of all the players in the delivery system? Or is it a bailout for failing hospitals in New York City? Yes. So and beyond that, I think every story is different. So the part of DSRIP that involves better building of connections and relationships is really valuable and long overdue. Whether there's enough time and enough resources to get that done, with everything else being changed simultaneously, the mental health care all moving into managed care, different arrangements, different parts of the state, plans have not done that before. That I don't have a clue about. But it's a well-intended idea, although it's got this other political component to it, and I hope it makes things better. Any other? Well, catch me over lunch. I think I have to pull a.
Yeah, let me take this.